Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, who provides an update on his lawsuit challenging U.S. indefinite detention policies and the urgency of restoring civil liberties lost since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Andrew Welton, a team leader of West Virginia's Testing Assessment Project, who discusses the lack of scientific information that caused public confusion in the wake of that state's recent toxic water spill. And Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina State Conference of the NAACP, who talks about his Moral Monday progressive protest movement that is now spreading to other states across the nation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For decades, Japan's political establishment has aggressively pushed the development of nuclear breeder reactors as a power source, which uses and produces plutonium. Despite years of delays, expensive cost overruns, and the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear complex in 2011, Japan still plans to open the massive $22 billion plutonium fuel plant at Rokkasho in the fall of 2014. For over a decade, Taro Kono, a popular member of parliament with deep ties to Japan's political establishment, campaigned against the new plutonium technology and its high cost. Yet his dissent was blocked by the pro-nuclear establishment of utility executives, regulators, engineers, and politicians known as the Nuclear Power Village. According to the Center for Public Integrity, technical problems and construction delays have prevented the plant from opening for over 20 years. The multi-billion dollar Rokkasho project came under brief scrutiny by Japan's powerful Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry in 2004 when a 26-page report titled "The Unstoppable Nuclear Fuel Cycle" charged that the plutonium-focused energy strategy was outdated and blasted pro-nuclear boosters as corrupt and guilty of conflicts of interest. However, the report was quickly repressed by Japan's power elite and purged from public files. While Japan recently pledged to transfer more than 700 pounds of weapons-grade plutonium to the U.S. to ensure its security, the Rokkasho plant, when operational, is capable of producing almost that many more tons of plutonium annually. Fast food workers are mobilizing against McDonald's and its franchises over wage theft. This is the latest chapter in the fight for higher wages for low-paid service workers. Street protests in mid-March followed class action lawsuits filed in California, Michigan, and New York over claims McDonald's workers were instructed by supervisors to work off the clock before and after their regular shifts. During a day of protests in 30 cities, activists in New York who stormed into a McDonald's near the Empire State Building at lunch hour were evicted by police. New York City public advocate Tish James, who joined the fast food workers, promised to push for legislation to create a hotline to report wage theft. In mid-March, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman announced a $500,000 wage settlement for McDonald's workers in Manhattan who had accused Richard Cisneros, owner of seven McDonald's franchises, of wage theft. Fast food worker protests emerged in 2012 over low and stagnant wages. The protests, supported by the Service Employees International Union, have fueled nationwide demands for an increase in the federal minimum wage, along with President Obama's call for Congress to pass an increase to $10.10 an hour. Lobbying pressure from car dealers, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and the State Motor Vehicle Commission has made it impossible for Tesla, the state-of-the-art electric car automaker, to sell cars in the Garden State. A new rule adopted by the Motor Vehicle Commission on March 11th prohibits car companies from using a direct sales method and requires all new dealers to obtain franchise agreements to receive a state operating license. Tesla has two showrooms in suburban New Jersey and, until now, has sold cars directly to consumers, bypassing established car dealers. In many states, Tesla has run into opposition from the car dealer lobby, but New Jersey is the first state to cave into demands that would bar Tesla-owned showrooms from doing business in the state. In the aftermath of the commission ruling, Tesla blasted Governor Christie of acting on behalf of a special interest group looking to protect its monopoly at the expense of New Jersey consumers. The New Jersey Sierra Club believes Christie is using this rules change in an effort to sidestep the state's Clean Cars Law auto fuel efficiency standard adopted in 2005. New Jersey Sierra Club's director Jeff Tittle worries that the lack of Tesla sales could prevent the state from reaching the law's benchmarks and be used as an argument to delay its implementation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
When President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, on December 31, 2011, civil liberties advocates were alarmed at several provisions within the legislation, including Section 1021 that empowers current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. A lawsuit challenging this measure was filed on January 13, 2012, on behalf of seven plaintiffs contesting the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions of the NDAA. The plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and MIT linguist, Noam Chomsky. On September 12, 2012, U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a permanent injunction that barred the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention to U.S. citizens. But the Obama administration appealed that decision to the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which on July 17, 2013, overturned Judge Forrest's permanent injunction, declaring that the plaintiffs lacked legal standing to challenge the indefinite detention powers specified in the NDAA. On December 16, 2013, the plaintiffs appealed their case to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they hope to overturn congressional support of presidential powers to indefinitely detain suspected terrorists. Your reporter spoke with journalist and author Chris Hedges, who provides an update on his case and talks about the urgency of restoring civil liberties lost since the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
I had spent 20 years overseas as a foreign correspondent, most of them with the New York Times. I was in frequent contact with groups that are on the State Department terrorism list or individuals who are members of those groups, including Al-Qaeda. And I had covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. And during that time, this was during the Reagan administration, the anger towards the press, we were exposing government atrocities. When I got to El Salvador in 1983, the government-backed death squads were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month, wholesale massacres of Salvadoran peasants. And because we were exposing these atrocities, we were attacked as being fifth columnists, as being members of the guerrillas, as et cetera, being sympathetic to the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And there was no distinction between us and the groups that we reported upon. And certainly I think that if the NDAA or if Section 1021 of the NDAA had been in effect at that time, they could have easily used it to criminalize the role of a free press, which is essentially to provide to all sides, all groups, even those that are hostile to the United States, a platform by which their views can be heard. So it wasn't academic to me. I think that the government, when it has that ability, you know, and what is substantially support? What are associated forces? No one knows. Now, it gives the government a great deal of leeway in terms of interpretation. And one of the things that they did in the appeal is the government lawyers kept saying that independent journalists, that was the word they used, had nothing to fear. Well, who is it who determines who is independent? And what happens when the government decides you're not independent for whatever reason? And certainly when I covered the war in El Salvador, you know, Ollie North and Poindexter and these figures within the Reagan administration did not consider us, quote unquote, independent.
We all just have to remember, with the recent passing of Nelson Mandela, former president of South Africa and freedom fighter with the African National Congress, that the ANC was designated as a terrorist group. So many of the organizations and individuals who supported the ANC in their struggle against apartheid in South Africa would have been deemed fellow travelers of terrorists and potentially imprisoned without access to attorneys, charges, or trial, just like we're seeing post-9/11. Is that right?
Of course. You know, I used to work with the PLO when it was deemed a terrorist group. Oftentimes these groups, which are liberation movements in the eyes of some and terrorist movements in the eyes of others, become your chief negotiating partners, as Arafat did and as, of course, Nelson Mandela did. So, you know, I find the whole rise of the security and surveillance state, the whole sort of stripping away of our civil liberties, which has been more egregious under the Obama administration than it was under the Bush administration, quite frightening. Because when you give government this kind of power, certainly when government feels threatened or when there is any kind of civil unrest, they'll use it. I mean, history has shown that.
With the continuing incarceration of many suspected terrorists in Guantanamo and elsewhere under indefinite detention, along with the revelations from Edward Snowden about the NSA's massive dragnet surveillance programs and the erosion of civil liberty since 9/11, do you believe the American people are sufficiently aware of the dangers to our civil liberties now? And what course of action do you recommend for concerned citizens to take action to restore and protect their constitutional rights?
I don't think people are sufficiently aware. We have, especially on the electronic media, a kind of complete collapse of real journalism. You have cable shows like Fox, which essentially become mouthpieces of the right wing. MSNBC is a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. But you didn't hear about it on MSNBC because it would have reflected poorly on Obama. You didn't hear about it on Fox because this has bipartisan support. But that was a window into how impoverished our journalism has become, that a case of this importance and this magnitude was not covered at all. I think since the Snowden revelations, it's been very hard for the government to mask the wholesale surveillance that they're carrying out of every American citizen and the storing of all of our personal information in perpetuity. And yet at the same time, I have yet to see any serious calls for reform, either by the administration or by congressional leaders. And that I find quite worrying, because if we don't wrest back our privacy, then we cannot talk about a free press. We cannot talk about the right to dissent. And I think it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that we cannot even talk any more about liberty.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, whose most recent book, co-written with cartoonist Joe Sacco, is titled Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Find more news and analysis on indefinite detention on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Shortly after MCHM, a chemical used in coal processing, spilled into the water supply of 300,000 West Virginians on January 9th, Andrew Welton, an assistant professor of civil engineering at South Alabama University, drove with a graduate student 900 miles to Charleston to advise residents on how to flush their water systems in order to minimize contact with the chemical. He initially went to assist as a volunteer, but because of his early efforts, he and a colleague were awarded a $750,000 grant by West Virginia to lead the state's testing assessment project. Professor Welton put together a global team of experts to study various aspects of the disaster. Most people affected by the toxic contamination were still not using tap water for drinking, though many were using it for other purposes in the weeks and months after the Do Not Use order was lifted, several days after the initial spill. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who spent several days in and around Charleston in early March reporting on the disaster, spoke with Professor Welton about his study, which he called historic. Here he talks about the problems that resulted from a lack of scientific information that led both the state and the water utility to declare the chemical non-detectable at a certain level, although Welton and his team were able to detect MCHM at far lower levels as they conducted studies of the water quality in 80 homes spread throughout the affected area.
We shipped the contaminant that was spilled into the river. We were able to get the actual chemical that was sequestered after it was spilled, or a residual in the tank, and we shipped that across the country to California to begin immediate odor testing of it to determine at what level you can smell it in water. We shipped it to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Monrovia, California, where they started characterizing it. The WBTAP team has started looking at the byproducts of how the different drinking water system chemicals interact with these chemicals that were spilled, because one of the concerns that we had up front was that we knew everybody was looking for crude MCHM, which is a mixture of at least 8 compounds, but many of the efforts had been focused on what's called 4-MCHM, which is one of those 8 compounds. We know from basic environmental chemistry and engineering that chemicals transform sometimes in water treatment plants into unintended byproducts. That actually has never been talked about by state officials or federal officials, and that is something that the scientific community has been asking for all along. So there's many, many people that have been sending me emails asking, why hasn't the government considered looking at other compounds that were produced? And we have done that.
So, Andrew Welton, when you and your team report your findings, will you be able to say whether or not the water is safe? That's what everyone was waiting for when I was down there 2 weeks ago. They were waiting for the results of the tests.
What you're referring to is just a basic understanding that everybody has, including us. What are the chemical levels in the water, and are those acceptable in terms of will they make me acutely sick or will they have chronic effects to not simply me, but my children, my friend's baby, my elderly grandmother? I mean, these are the questions that people are asking, and they have every right to do so because I would be asking the same thing. The toxicology panel that the WVTAP program is convening will examine the available data to determine if the levels that the state of West Virginia have instituted, the 10 part per billion or 10 ppb level for MCHM, are protective of public health. Next, they'll also look at the CDC's level of 1,000 part per billion to see if that level was protective of public health. And I expect, I can't speak for the panel, but I expect that they will make recommendations in terms of what other information should have been available to make certain determinations. Now, one of the major points that a lot of critics, including myself, make was that at the very beginning, a lot of the declarations that the water was safe to drink or that a certain level of chemical is acceptable weren't really backed up with enough public scrutiny in terms of availability of knowledge and availability of data and outside vetting. And so what we are doing is we are coming in through the expert panel and actually trying to determine if what happened in terms of what levels cause acute or chronic health effects are valid. What's important to recognize here, and I know that throughout this incident, everybody's been talking about part per billion or ppb and ppm. The fact of the matter is the screening level that West Virginia set for its population was 10 part per billion. And they did this because at the time, I do know that analytical laboratories could only get the 10 part per billion. So they could only conclusively say that a chemical was present above 10 part per billion. The odor results that Dr. Mark McGuire has come out with basically demonstrate that at very, very low levels, you can still smell some type of odor in that water with crude MCHM in it, even if the water is determined safe to drink at 10 part per billion.
Does that mean it really isn't safe, or people don't know?
That's a great question. The odor is one component of this, mainly because throughout the incident, the state, as well as the utility, were declaring the chemical was not present. The chemical for MCHM was not present at a certain level. So they would say, it's non-detect at 10 part per billion. And then the public would say, but my water smells like licorice. And the response was, but it's non-detect at 10 part per billion. Or more recently, non-detect at 3 part per billion. And somebody will say, but my water smells like licorice. Well, Dr. McGuire's work demonstrates that, first of all, there's a messaging issue here, that just because you can't detect something doesn't mean it's not there. and it's not causing problems, which then raises the concern by homeowners and somebody, me included, that what is causing the odor and what concentration is it?
That was Andrew Welton, an assistant professor of civil engineering at South Alabama University, who pulled a team together to investigate the toxic chemical spill into the water supply of 300,000 West Virginians. Find more information on the West Virginia chemical spill and lax regulation on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 8th, an estimated 80,000 people from North Carolina and 41 other states across the nation gathered in the state capital of Raleigh to protest the Republican Party-controlled state government's extremist agenda. Since North Carolina's GOP took control of all branches of government in 2010, the party has passed one of the nation's harshest voter suppression laws, cut back education funding, imposed new anti-abortion regulations, and rejected federal funding to expand Medicaid coverage for 170,000 working poor families. The protest rally on that winter day, the largest civil rights gathering in the South since the 1965 Selma to Montgomery March in Alabama, was the culmination of months of what they called Moral Monday protests and nonviolent civil disobedience actions organized at the state capitol since April 2013. The primary organizer of these protests is Reverend William J. Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP, whose morally based progressive movement for change has now spread to other states, including Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Wisconsin, and New York. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Barber, who talks about building a movement that is beginning to resonate across race and class lines around the nation.
What you have is Tea Party extremists, Koch brother extremists. I took over the legislature and the governorship. Immediately, they tried to turn back years of victories that we had already won. You know, we had won same-day registration, early voting. We had won more money to public education and Affordable Care Act, and we had won major changes through our coalition. They immediately, in the first 50 days, decided to pursue this avalanche of extreme policy, denying 500,000 people Medicaid expansion, 170,000 people unemployment, 900,000 people earned income tax credit, raised taxes on 89% of North Carolinians, give tax cuts to 11% of North Carolinians, created a new system of trickle-down voodoo economics, cut $1 billion from public education, driving us to 48th in the nation. And then they decided in the middle of March of April, to attack voting rights and pass the worst voter suppression bill we've seen since Jim Crow and even before the Shelby case. That was too much and too far. So 17 of us went in on April 29th, built on our strong coalition. We had already brought 17,000 people to the legislature last year for voting a progressive agenda on economic sustainability, education for all, health care for all, addressing the criminal justice system, and promoting and defending labor rights, voting rights, women's rights, LGBT rights, immigrants' rights. But when they went this far, we went in, 17 of us, to protest. They arrested us. The next week, 34 went in. The next week, 68 came in. By the end of the summer, 45 people had been arrested, all different races, creeds, colors, kind of political parties. Thousands of people have come. We've now done 110 Moral Monday events, different events related to Moral Monday. The governor has dropped in the polls from 50 to under 30, nearly. Legislation under 19%. And many North Carolinians of all different persuasions are saying they agree with this argument that some issues are not about Democrat, Republican, liberal versus Democrat, but what's right, what's wrong.
Reverend Barber, in the history of social justice movements, there's been a long debate about the utility of electoral politics versus building a grassroots movement such as yours that employs nonviolent civil disobedience based on moral and religious principles of fairness and equality. Where do you come down on that debate? I guess it's not exclusive. We could have both, but certainly your movement has tapped a power among North Carolinians and people around the country that maybe wasn't possible with electoral politics alone.
Well, I don't think people are ultimately moved by the limited language of Democrat, Republican, liberal versus conservative. People really have to do movements have to be touched at a much deeper level. But it's almost like the question, is it race or is it class? And I just answer yes. It's both. Movements will have electoral consequences, but people can't be a movement just based on election. Even politicians can't be moved just on elections. And one thing a moral movement does, Walter Brueggemann is one of the theologians that talks about the so-called prophetic critique of the Bible. And he says one of the things it does is it gives people subversive hope, the kind of hope that allows you to question the allegiances of the majority that you have given yourself over to and believe that things do not have to be according to the majority opinion, that there is an alternative way, there's a better way, there's higher ground, if you will. There is a place where we can come together and be the beloved community. And that is essential, not just for the next election, but it's essential to change the consciousness of the electorate, because you need a conscious change in the electorate that's bigger than just one election. If we found out anything, you can't simply have electoral politics. We had electoral politics. We elected Obama, and then a lot of people went back home, went to sleep. So in 2010, you get an upsurge because many of the people who came out one year didn't come out another. We need to change the consciousness of people.
Tell our listeners about how your movement, the Moral Monday movement, is spreading out from North Carolina to other states, both in the South and beyond the South. I know Georgia and South Carolina have similar protest movements that have launched recently. But tell us the kind of interest that your movement has had around the country and how it's resonated with people well beyond North Carolina's borders.
This movement is not about some national leader helicoptering in and having an event. It's about homegrown leadership, indigenous leadership, building from the ground up. We've seen people in South Carolina building a movement focused on their state legislature and state government. Florida has had a beginning. Alabama is starting in their legislature. We're going to Missouri on April the 1st. We've been to Wisconsin, 0 degrees, 700 people show up. Because people understand that we are in the middle, I believe, of a kind of third reconstruction. And in the midst of that, what we must have is a movement, not a moment, of people that are brought together by a common agenda, a fusion-type coalition that will not only challenge extremism, but even call on people who are not extremists, who are more progressive, to stand up and fight back, as we say, forward together, not one step back.
That was Reverend William J. Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP and leader of his state's Moral Monday movement. Find links to more news and commentary on this new movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.